The Great Canadian Talk Show.
It was only a couple of watts, but I brought the truth to everyone within three blocks of the west side of campus.
No way! Yes way!
And now, let's get right down to business with Marty Gold.
Welcome to the Great Canadian Talk Show podcast. This is episode 41 of season 4. I'm Marty Gold. You know, there are times where I sit in the chair and then I get back up and I think about things and then I go, you know, wash the dishes or make a couple of calls or double check some emails. But there are times where instead of diving right in, I sit down, I organize the notes, something's not quite there yet. And I stand up and go do something else. And boy, today is an example of that because I'm going to have in this program, I'm going to be telling you about something I was asking questions about with regards to the provincial government and didn't get an answer. I got asked a question, but I didn't get an answer. And that very peculiar, very, very, very peculiar just popped up late on Friday as I record this. And so I've rejigged the script to tell you that I was ahead of the curve on something and didn't even know it. Not an unusual situation around here. I want to thank all the listeners. As usual, I want to thank our donors. I want to thank those of you that are relatively new to the program. This is going to have a Crime Court's public safety update. I'm going to put that at the back end, although for the most part, the entire episode is about public safety, to a lesser extent about crime. And I'm not sure there's anything specifically court-related in here. I'm not able to get into the questions raised at City Hall that were supposed to be raised at City Hall because I didn't watch the council meeting, whether Councilor Barwati followed through with his questions for Mayor Gillingham about the disposition of monies that are owed in relation to the Canada Post conversion to a police headquarters and court decisions that were not favorable to the likes of Phil Schiegel and others. And other out-of-court agreements with one of the contractors. I didn't see the council meeting. I've done a fast search. Doesn't look like anybody's reported on what kind of an answer Barwati did or didn't get, if he even asked the question. And I apologize, I was too busy to message Barwati at a convenient time to be able to ask him, hey, did you ask Gillingham and what did he say? Is the check in the mail or is Phil Schiegel mark the envelope, you know, they sent a written inquiry, hey, where's our money? And he's just sort of struck off, return to sender. And I don't know, but I'll be getting to that at some point in the future. I am sure a lot of this episode turns out to be about provincial matters, but I want to firstly thank all of you who for the response we've gotten to our most immediate recent podcast, the interview with Jerry Singer, brother of Brad Singer, the episode on April 24th, family gets ambulance and cleanup bills, but no answers after cop shooting. And there's other individuals in the community that have concerns about what's going on with altercations or incidents with police in the course of arrests or attempted arrests or whatever. And might be another one in this line, in this vein, that I might be picking up on in the next couple of weeks. We'll see what the response is from the individual who made a comment about our story, saying that they had similar questions for the police about their loved one and didn't get satisfactory responses from the police service. Excuse me. First on this episode, what we call an LTE letter, the editor, in this case, LTME, letter to me. With regards to the appearance by Kelly Ryback on the episode, I guess it was number 39, Winnipeg in Crisis, Housing, Homelessness, and Hard Drugs. And that episode got a lot of traction. And Ryback, of course, very knowledgeable about things in and around City Hall. And he addressed a number of different issues as we had a long, wide-ranging discussion. It went far longer than I expected. But the listener reaction to it was also better than I would have expected. People hung in there and they maybe picked or chose which segment they'd want, especially the bonus audio complaint about Sherry Rowlands, Council Rowlands, having been filed by one of our listeners and how she treated them when they appeared as a delegation at City Hall. In regards to that episode, another list of our listeners having a response to Kelly Ryback's points And I'm going to go through that right now. I listened with interest to your recent interview with Kelly Ryback on homelessness, crime, and addiction. Ryback pointed out the high number of Indigenous people involved with crime, homelessness, and drug addiction. He explained the disproportionate involvement of Indigenous people was due to Indian residential schools in the 60s scoop and how they disrupted parenting among Indigenous communities. Listener then, with a small recap of those things, is it reasonable to suppose events that transpired nearly two generations ago are still affecting how Indigenous people parent today? The one constant that is never mentioned is the reserve system, which is more likely to have an influence on Indigenous people today, things that happened decades ago or things that are happening now. Most reserves are desperate places where unemployment dependency on welfare is the norm, dependency on welfare, especially when it spans generations. And ensuing lifestyles of NUE are much more likely to result in poor or absent parenting. Wab Kanu, they wrote, didn't become premier because his parents remained on a reserve. Marie Sinclair didn't become a judge and senator because he remained on reserve. The chiefs and activists, Sinclair included, want to preserve the reserve system at all costs for ideological reasons. The wish for Aboriginal sovereignty is meaningless without a land base, and reserves constitute that minimum land base. Well, that's an interesting way of looking at things. At one level, it would seem immaterial. What are the root causes for so much dysfunction? We have people in trouble and they need help, but if the causes are seen as historic events and not as something that is still happening, it means we are trapped in a cycle of putting out fires that keep getting lit. If Ryback and others were correct about the disruption of parenting caused by the 60s scoop and residential schools, we would see a similar high rate of Aboriginal social pathologies among former school students and adoptees. We don't. I don't even know how to respond to that last part. I have to think about what it means and where you would find that kind of data. I think I understand the sense they're trying to get across is that this after effect doesn't seem to be consistent among certain demographics, maybe within the First Nations community. But keep in mind, while I respect what was said here, and there definitely is a lot of talk circulating about the Indian Act and whether it has been for decades, that it's actually something that is detrimental to the advancement of Aboriginal communities, Aboriginal well-being in the context of greater society, that we're talking about two different things here. This letter writer talking about the effects of people still on reserve pretty much, but you've got generations now of First Nations people, Indigenous people in Winnipeg that are essentially, you know, what used to be called, please don't light your hairs on fire, used to be called urban Indians. And that has evolved over time, and it's now a substantial number of people that live in Winnipeg that have no connection to the reserve or where they came from. And in some cases, this goes back, I know, to the early 90s, the 90, 91, when the first time I remember that the forest fires were so bad up north that people were evacuated and brought into the city in great numbers. And my understanding is that a lot of families didn't go back or came back to Winnipeg shortly thereafter. And so this is a problem with a couple of different sides to the coin, so to speak. But Kelly Ryback's comments not having touched on the reserve system and whether that's contributing to the handing down of social dysfunction from generation to generation, a good point being made by that listener. And this isn't really an isolated, the concerns about what goes on reserves and whether the way things are run, when things couldn't be done a whole lot better. And this isn't the question of, you know, fire trucks that are granted or donated to communities where they don't have the money or resources to maintain the trucks. So they don't even train anybody on how to drive the truck. This is beyond that. They're bigger picture items, as the Manitoba government in particular is so committed to so-called decolonization and bestowing further independence, further autonomy on First Nations communities. One of their own MLAs going against the script in committee, speaking as a delegation. Is it delegates at the province? I don't remember. I don't remember if that term is used, and I've been there. Amanda Laflin is a backbencher representing the PAW in the Manitoba legislature. and has been an NDP backbencher, I think, pretty much since the death of her father, Oscar. I think she took over the seat then, and that goes back, I'm just guessing, 2008 or something? So she's been in government for a long time, and she spoke up as a foster parent. I'm worried about the nepotism that's currently going on in every office with regards to child and family services under the jurisdiction of Indian bans. She referred to ban politics and bullshit before apologizing for her language to the committee. There's a federal bill that provides for the inherent right of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis to develop their own CFS systems. She's worried about the First Nations handling this authority. That's a direct quote. I'm worried about the nepotism that's currently going on. Unqualified workers that are currently there, such as the ones who are not returning my calls for 2 months asking for a visit to explain. Lathan, who has a child of her own, has ended up raising three children of her sister. The sister dying of a drug overdose, I think it was just this past fall. And this may explain, I believe, in the first session of the House, people raised the absence of Lathan from the House apparently through the entire session. And that might explain it, though I'd never heard it explained until I read this and put two and two together and actually came up with what might be four. How do we go and say, hey, that worker's not... Who do we go to, she says, and say, hey, that worker's not returning my call, pointing out she's the MLA. I'm not even being heard as the MLA. Who do we report to in such situations? And then the children's advocate, Sherry Gott, also appeared before the legislative committee and said someone needs to speak up for the children in care. And when they detach this and give autonomy to the First Nations communities, the individual bands, or I guess maybe it would go to the regions, there's no mechanism in there for an advocate or an ombudsman for the children and the families. Nahani Fontaine, your family's minister, said her government supports the federal bill C-92 and the decolonization of the child welfare system. She said it's important, this is what she said to the committee, for people to understand that once First Nations establish their own child welfare laws, they're paramount. The province has no oversight at all, and the advocate has no oversight at all, which is exactly what Lathan and Sherry Gott were complaining about. My recommendation still stands. Oh, this was, she said this to Sherry Gott. My recommendation still stands. There needs to be a voice for those children under the new federal legislation for child welfare. Late Friday, Fontaine, trying to put out the proverbial fire, put out a statement saying that the government's committed to helping kids in care and working with Indigenous nations to improve child welfare in our province. What happens if an Aboriginal family, First Nations family, files, can they file a complaint under the Human Rights Act? Probably not. Maybe the Federal Human Rights Act. If they, something's going sideways, they're being denied access to a kid, being denied file information. What recourse do they actually have? This, of course, is something that the Trudeau government has not bothered even for a moment figuring out. How contentious is this situation? The committee's got 19 presenters scheduled next Friday, and they've extended the deadline for people to give written submissions to May 24th. So a lot of people very concerned about the devolution, right? And we've seen what's happened in other cases with this concept of devolution and the tragic consequences for some kids and for some families. And so Lathan, bucking caucus, bucking Nahani Fontaine, and I credit Sherry Gott as well, the children's advocate, for speaking out and issuing, you know, a voice of caution. Now, to get to what I was mentioning, and this once again touches on Nahani Fontaine, although more so on Bernadette Smith, the housing minister. A few weeks ago, over a month ago, I sent an inquiry following up on a request for proposals the province had issued previously that concluded at the end of October, I think it was, looking for people to redevelop that god-awful, ghastly, award-winning, abandoned housing complex on Balmoral Street, as you're in between Notre Dame and Sargent on the east side. It's very famous, of course, award-winning architecture, and just, how do I put this, soul-draining incompetence with how after 10 years that had to be locked up, boarded up, repeated fires, repeated break-ins, a menace to the neighborhood. Manitoba Housing completely ineffective in trying to police it, their own property, and, of course, no tickets, no charges ever laid against Manitoba Housing officials for their negligence because, you know, they're not private landlords, therefore they can't be held responsible, apparently. Well, I had put in an inquiry to the housing minister, actually to the, I guess it's sort of the procurement side, but through the Department of Housing, what happened with this RFP? It closed the end of October, and my understanding is that there had been no public discussion, no, I want to find out, did somebody win? Is it being reissued? What's going on? It turns out that Bernadette Smith and her buddy Nanny Fontaine and the AMC were going to be holding a press conference at 9 o'clock on Friday, but at 8:30, the cops showed up because there was a report of a body, and a dead male was found inside, believed to be a drug or medical issue. I was going to say drug overdose. I don't think they've concluded that. That's the, I think, suspicion. But now you're calling off the press conference at the fenced off complex. Now, still littered with trash. Free Press report on Friday. Many of the windows bordered with plywood have been smashed. Who gets charged in that? Mayor Gillingham. Is the parking authority going to go and write up a ticket for Manitoba Housing under the bylaws? And this is, again, it's a serious problem. Manitoba Housing is the owner, yet they aren't held responsible for this ongoing neglect. Why not? There's a fellow who spoke to the Free Press, who I've requoted here on this program a couple of times in the past, saying Manitoba, he says security doesn't drive by. Manitoba Housing says they do, but they don't. He's lived opposite this place for 8 years, and it was boarded up. So it was already a disaster before he moved in, actually, which I think is around the time that it got closed up. He's spent the past 2 years watching constant break-ins, drug use, theft, and vandalism go on unabated. Unabated. If you're a private landlord, can you get away with it? Last month, a provincial spokesman said plans were being worked on behind the scenes. And the housing minister suggested an update on the property's future was near, which I guess explains why when I made the inquiry as a member of the community, the person responding on behalf of the government said, what group are you with? I go, I'm not with any group. I'm like, people in the community are concerned. And they never got back to me. They didn't want to tell me. And they didn't invite me to this press conference, which in the end, if I'd have gone to, would have gotten rained on for nothing. The property was offered for sale for $1. Meanwhile, as that neglect, as that eyesore is propagated on the community, the fellow lives across the street, Keenan, what did he say? Everything goes unheard in this neighborhood. We've gotten used to it. Where's the city councilor on this? Would that be Cindy Gilroy? I think. Would that be Daniel McIntyre? It must be. Where is she on this? Why does the neighborhood say that their concerns are unheard? Manitoba government also, I'll touch on this since we're on a bit of a roll before we get into the first break. Then I'll be back with the Crime Court's public safety update. Dr. Eberhard Renner issued an opinion piece this past week. He was the head of the Department of Internal Medicine and the provincial specialty lead for shared health. He recently resigned from both. And so the NDP's heading for their first real big healthcare scandal. This guy quit. He is a top doctor, and we've lost him. Why? Well, he complains about what led him to, you know, he had to make the decision to resign. And he used this analogy about recycling, the city of Winnipeg recycling. He said, there's definitely recycling going on in Manitoba. Don't believe me? Consider this. Are we not among the top in the country, maybe even worldwide, in recycling previous health system leaders who would elsewhere compost in retirement? How exactly is it that resurrecting previous leaders will help our failing health system getting back on track in a rapidly changing societal environment? Can they truly be said to have been effective when they were in charge previously? If they would our health system be failing the extent it is today? What possible magic would any of them make any of them more effective now? Oh, what's he talking about exactly? Well, among his recommendations is that, and he made three principal recommendations, this guy, and he's no dummy. And among those recommendations is that shared health be sort of properly constituted to manage the affairs, and that there's too much of this silo business going on. But it's not just siloing. It's sort of the flip side of nepotism that's mentioned by Lathlin with regards to family services in those kinds of environments, right? This is political nepotism. You help me win an election, I recycle you as your reward into a lucrative and influential position. Who is he talking about? Well, that would be Dr. Brain Postal, a guy who famously, when he was in charge of the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority, wanted the Regional Health Authority to sick the lawyers on us on Kick FM for daring to ask questions about some of their conduct, some of their behavior towards the media and the withholding of information. We filed FIPAs, all sorts of things. He said, call the lawyers. Brian Postal was resurrected by the NDP to take over the shared health. And this very effective doctor quit. Now, who do you think knows more, Brian Postal or this guy? Like its predecessor, he says, this government, meaning the NDP government, meddles relentlessly in our health system without empowering those with expertise to run it. This government's actions, frankly, hinder the ability of expert leaders to do their job. An increasingly uncoordinated, ill-advised, and micromanaging government is either uninterested or unable to take the critical steps to coordinate health service delivery in this province. It is truly the Wild West. Stakeholders and regions in our health system look out only for themselves, their own little silo, disregarding due process. And the chain of command, this is fueled by the success each partisan actions have, with the government's listening to hear from and engaging with everyone, and too often in an uncritical way. As a provincial specialty lead, I feel accountable for, but no longer in control of my service area, an impossible situation I'm no longer willing to accept. Item last, I guess, before I hit the break, the province announcing a new provincial strategy to build on sacred work of sexual assault care providers. And this, of course, as usual, it involves both the health minister, of course, Uzoma Zaguara, and Nahani Fontaine. This announcement made a couple of days ago. And this relates to a provincial assault response strategy will be developed by the by some committee. Who's on the committee? Dr. Yvette Emerson, Dr. Vanessa Polikin, and Leslie Spillett. Well, there you have that political nepotism at play. Spillett, the mentor of Nahani Fontaine, the mentee, and now she gets appointed to a working group, once again, surely with a per diem, on matters of sexual assault. And this will incorporate the work of nurses, physicians, elders, community partners, all the usual kinds of factors going on. What did Nahani Fontaine say? Caring for survivors of sexual violence is sacred work, which is why we rely on the support of experts. There's so much more to do to protect women, girls, and two-spirit peoples, and we will center the experience of those survivors and the expertise of the communities to care for them to shape the path forward. Well, that's all very interesting. But I'm not quite sure where in this strategy gay men fit in. Do gay men not get beaten up by their partners? I mean, for that matter, how does Nahani Fontaine define what is a woman? So the emphasis in this program, and I'm not saying that it's wrong, women, girls, so she's acknowledging a gender binary there, and two-spirit peoples, but that's not the same as domestic violence that's occurring in homosexual, what they used to define as homosexual relationships. Is there an acronym for what I'm trying to describe now? I'm not sure what help men get. There isn't a men's shelter, is there, for battered men? Well, and you know what? Not even necessarily gay men being in altercations with their same-sex spouses. Men who are assaulted by women, by female spouses and partners. Where are they supposed to go? I don't see any indication in this that there's any thought of that by Nahani Fontaine and the health minister and the provincial NDP. Just before I go to the break, the Free Press, you might have noticed, picking up a few, about a week after we did, we got the news out first about Heather Stephenson, the former premier, leaving the legislature, or planning to leave the legislature, and leave politics. Nice of the Free Press to, and the at least somebody in the media caught on to what we had put out there, and we were, in fact, ahead of the curve in that regard. Off to a break, then, the Crime Court's public safety update. We're going to be talking about somebody charged in three murders. We're going to be talking as well, going to touch on what's going on with the fire department and a bizarre he said, she said, but there's not really, they're all he's, involving two schools in Manitoba and conflicting versions of whether there was bad behavior on an exchange trip. Back with more right after this from our sponsors.
The Crime Courts and Public Safety Update is sponsored by Jamrock Security. For your home, your family, your business, your employees, and for your community, Jamrock provides affordable protection solutions. Call 204-880-1564 or go online, jamrocksecurity.ca. Do security. Do it smart. Jamrock Security.
The Great Canadian Talk Show podcast is always listening to you. Send in your comments, story tips, and ideas to martygoldlive@gmail.com, TGCTS, making sure your voice is heard.
When you support the Great Canadian Talk Show, your donation makes sure that the investigations, the interviews, the fact-finding, the truth-telling can carry on. When you sponsor the Great Canadian Talk Show, you're telling the community that you think their stories matter. Our public affairs coverage continues to make a difference, challenging the slanted media narratives and giving a voice to the community. When you provide funding for the Great Canadian Talk Show, you're supporting old-fashioned investigative reporting that matters. Support TGCTS today.
Back with the Crime Court's Public Safety Update, brought to you by Jamrock Security. As a reminder, every episode of the Great Canadian Talk Show podcast can be heard at actionline.ca under the podcast tab. We have various categories covering the city, covering the province, covering crime, covering even sports. And I'm going to try to get another one out one of these days. A couple of sports items. And, of course, under the blog post, various articles. And I'm working through the production pace here. We've got a bit of a trick over the course of the next week, but we're going to get over the hump. I want to mention that our next podcast is going to be another interview, and similar to the interview with Jerry Singer about Brad Singer and that interaction with police and the grief and the difficulty that family, the Singers, have experienced in the aftermath. Here's another family has come forward to the Great Canadian Talk Show podcast with concerns about how a 911 call was handled. They have legitimate questions, legitimate concerns, and they're getting stonewalled. And we will be telling their story on the next edition of TGCTS. And I anticipate we're going to put that out on Monday, I think, is when that's going to be released, that interview. You're going to want to listen to it. We provide the best interviews in all of Winnipeg radio because we aren't on radio. We are right here on actionline.ca with this podcast. And especially timely that this next one, because the police put out a tweet. I know this sounds kind of bizarre about 911. And if you call 911, you should be calm and follow the instructions. Actually, hold on. Listen, let's turn the volume up. Let's see if you can hear this.
Hi, I'm Jen from the 911 Communication Center. Staying calm can be difficult in an emergency, but it's also one of the most important things to do. If you need to call 911, stay calm, listen to the call taker's questions, and answer to the best of your ability. This will ensure the right resources are sent to help.
That's great, but what happens when the resources aren't sent? That's going to be on the next episode of the Great Canadian Talk Show podcast. Let's firstly talk in this Crime Court's Public Safety Update very quickly. A fellow named Maxim Dale Garneau was already in custody, charged with a shooting death in the 300 block of Manitoba in March. He was already in custody. Why? Because he'd been arrested for a shooting that happened 2 days after that in the 1200 block of Selkirk. So Selkirk Avenue, he killed somebody 2 days before that, somebody on Manitoba. And then last fall on College Avenue, that was in the, right by College and Charles, between Charles and Main, I guess, where fellow Daniel Raymond Garvey Rodriguez, and we talked about that at the time, right after September 10th, he was found dead on College Avenue. So Maxim Dale Garneau already in custody for two of the shootings. And then in between those two, there was another one he's been charged with now, three homicides. Interesting, the police say the homicides are not linked to each other, but I believe it was indicated that he knew all three. And so there is some link, whether it's drugs or something else, why he was going throughout the North End, whether it was settling scores or collecting or something. The question is with Garneau, and the court records, I guess, aren't necessarily clear, but it appears that He has some sort of a disability relating to FASD. This is another example of somebody who's out in the community that just has continually gotten into trouble. I mean, he actually, when you look at it, here's a guy committed 3 murders, and the media is not talking about that. When was the last time you had somebody who was charged with 3 separate murders as opposed to, you know, killing 2 or 3 people at a time or something? That's a bad sign that he was did it and was on the loose for so long and allegedly, put that word in, committed more killings. Mostly the question is, why was this guy out in public to begin with? I want to tip my hat to the fire department, fire paramedic service, continuing to respond to calls on Wednesday night, 300 block Selkirk, big surprise, another fire on Selkirk. And there was one, I think, on 600 Selkirk earlier in the week. And then on Thursday, 1200 Alexander, and that was around 9 in the morning. And then about 20 minutes later, another fire in the 1900 block of Elgin. So 1200 Alexander, 1900 Elgin. Those are both basically in the Western Brooklyn's area. Firebug, good bet. The house on Elgin is being demolished. That is, it's unfortunate anytime homes have to be demolished. And matter of fact, both homes are being demolished. Very unfortunate. Now, item last, and this, again, is sort of late breaking as I record this. The Free Press one day reports on an RCMP investigation into what they called a bullying incident when teenagers from a southern Manitoba school went to another school on a camping trip, you know, integrate the kids in with each other, cultural exchange, I think in my day is what it was called, in northern Manitoba. So this was with the Norway House, and the allegations were that students from Norway House targeted teen boys from Elm Creek, and this was supposed to be a truth and reconciliation. That was the premise of this exchange program. There's a video that went around the Elm Creek community, and one of the parents talking with the Free Press said it's disgusting, inappropriate, not okay. Threats, inappropriate spanking, and dry humping. So this is sexualized behavior in a way. It's certainly aggressive. That's what this parent was describing. Telling the newspaper, my understanding is they basically targeted one student at a time, kind of gang up one at a time. One of the boys was so scared, he slept in the girls' tent the whole camping trip because they were short a tent. And supposedly the security or chaperones, I guess there were chaperones, but no security, didn't show up. When my child returned home, they were traumatized by the situation. That's how this one parent described it. They said that they had heard about the incident from their child and received a phone call from Elm Creek school staff about a week after the trip. This is last, I think, October, saying concerns had been raised. That's a quote, concerns had been raised. Now this goes to the RCMP on February 14th. Boy, a lot of things happened on February 14th. The RCMP confirmed that they are investigating. Well, the Free Press, the dreaded Malakabas, was put on the case. Tyler Searle writing the first piece, Malakabas writing the second piece. Parent blames racism for allegations of bullying at teen's trip. And I read that and I thought, they're saying that racism was behind the bullying behavior, right? In this case, the white kids, and they'd be very white kids from Elm Creek, believe you me, they go up to the home turf of these other kids and teenagers acting the way teenagers can and will. And I read this headline like racism was behind these white kids being bullied and being aggressed upon by the First Nations kids. Well, they should have come up with a better headline because that's not what the story actually says. And I'm not saying that they didn't think that's how the headline would be interpreted, but that's not how I think myself and a lot of other people would interpret it. Here's a woman who says her teenage son was filmed in this incident and that this was nothing, and that people saying that there was inappropriate behavior or reason for concern, that they're being racist. Actually, she spoke to him about the incident when he came home, she says, because parents, this other parent, Megan Jones, she said her son had told her he was videoed while sharing a tent with the other students and described it as brief roughhousing. So her son was part of the group that was allegedly bullied. He said, in his words, they were just kind of fooling around. She spoke to him about the incident when he came home because parents had raised concerns about the camper's conduct. She said he quickly dismissed those concerns as inaccurate and influenced by anti-Indigenous racism. Personally, she said, I believe that this is fueled by racism. I think the kids didn't want to go, made the time they spent, they're awful. And the kids that went with an open mind or willing to learn the culture of the other communities had the time they had. So here's a parent saying this is an invention, that her kid was on the video and he said, nah, mom, it's nothing. And well, did she see the actual video? And she also then casts doubt on these concerns of her fellow parents. She wonders, said the newspaper story, why the unnamed parent reached out to the Free Press now as opposed to in October when the trip ended, or after his report to RCMP in February. Oh, does that really matter? Does it? It comes out now, the RCMP gets in February, parents continue to talk, wondering whether the RCMP is going to come forward. Somebody goes to the media and she, well, why didn't they just... Very, very weird that one parent is trying to drive a wedge between with the other parents. When the interpretation of the first parent of the first story was that this was sexualized behavior and completely inappropriate and clearly went beyond roughhousing. Okay, now something's happened because Brian O'Leary, he of O'Leary Gate of Black Rod fame, is now the Deputy Minister of Education and the Deputy Minister of Families. So this is Nello Altamari's lieutenant and Nanny Fontaine's lieutenant, jointly sent a letter to the two school divisions involved, Prairie Rose School Division and Frontier School Division, about mandatory reporting of child protection and child abuse protocol. The parent who spoke to the Free Press Thursday said security was supposed to be present on the trip, but staff never showed up. RCMP have evidently still investigating. Are these allegations racism, or was the incident itself, if true, predicated by some kind of racism, the picking on these kids? Elm Creek with a population of like under 500 people and 10% at best are Indigenous. So what was going on, or were kids making something out of nothing from the way that one parent described the video? I don't think so. We'll continue to keep an eye on that situation. And we've got contacts out in southern Manitoba. Actually, if you know any of those parents or know any of those families or have any information, then get a hold of me. Your news tips, your comments, interact donations, of course, always welcome, believe you me, at martygoldlive@gmail.com. I'm going to wrap things up there so you can get through your weekend. And then coming up next will be... interview with a family that's got serious questions about Winnipeg's 911 service. And you're going to hear some very surprising information, including information that I found out that surprised my interview guest. Also, in the pipeline, so to speak, because we love pipelines here, the war over math education in Manitoba, I've done a history. I've looked into the history over the course of the last 15 or so, 20 years here in Manitoba. It's fascinating, and I'm doing something in that episode that nobody else has tried to do about the infusion of critical race theory and critical CRT practitioners into the education system, and particularly math. So I'm providing an analysis of that. I expect there's going to be more interviews coming up as well. We're getting a good response to them, and we're going to, I think, ramp up the interviews because it's obviously there's a demand. People want to hear directly from those that are involved in news stories, that have a story to tell, that have an issue, that have a concern. And nobody does a better interview in this town than me. And I say that quite proudly. So there's going to be more interviews. As I said, what we had previously slugged, math is hard for lefties. It's actually leftists are making math hard in Manitoba is actually what I've learned when I've produced that piece. And we'll, of course, have more crime court public safety updates, more looks at City Hall, the Legislative Assembly, and maybe we'll even talk about Phil Schlegel, fire halls, police headquarters, and those old stories that never really get out of the headlines, no matter how many years pass by. I hope you have a good weekend. I'm going to be off on Saturday, Rivers, Manitoba, with a Canadian Wrestling's Elite fundraiser for the fire department out there next week. I'll be in Morden, Gladstone. Let me do an order. Gladstone, May 1st on Wednesday. Morden on Thursday, and then in Winnipeg, the Holy Eucharist Parish Center for the Point to Prove Tour. Big event with just going to be great action up and down the card. That's going to be next Friday night in Elmwood. If you want to attend any of those shows, then email me and I'll try to put it together and get you tickets or give you the details you need. As I continue to host wrestling around Manitoba here in my twilight years, bringing joy and joy and great action, athleticism, and occasionally surprising endings to the matches that keep the fans entertained. As I say, I'm running out the string here, but boy, these shows, they're drawing good. The communities are turning out. There are a lot of wrestling fans in Manitoba. It's a real pleasure to meet them, whether they're in, as I said, Winnipeg, Gladstone, Morden, Rivers, Manitoba. We're going to be going to other places all throughout the spring and summer. I'll be doing that as a part. And if you want a wrestling show booked for as a fundraiser or part of your organization's ongoings, or in other jurisdictions, they've done bar mitzvah parties. So I suppose we'd be the first to do that here. Again, drop me a line, martygoldlive@gmail.com. We'll make that happen. That's all for this episode. By all means, send me your comments. Send me your story tips. Let me know what you're thinking. We'll continue to speak out for you because you have the power. Thank you for listening.
Trying to be Winnipeg's only alternative media source is hard work.
Now, while the Joss Reimers of the city parrot this nonsense on your godforsaken AM radio choices in this town,
one man has the skill, experience, and passion to deal with pomposity, corruption, and daring to report on what others can't, won't, or have been told not to report on.
This isn't a surprise that our leaders put on a dog and pony show. They put on airs. They play their roles. They have a big head. High opinions of themselves, trying to continue to go along to get along.
The Great Canadian Talk Show with Marty Gold.
Thanks for listening to The Great Canadian Talk Show. If you want to email Marty, send it to tgcts1@gmail.com or follow him on Twitter @tgcts.